Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Prize-winning poetry, this week on Soundings. Join me for readings and conversation featuring winners of the Nobel and Levinson Prizes for poetry, Czeslaw Milosz of the University of California, Berkeley, and Linda Gregerson of the University of Michigan. I'll talk first with Linda Gregerson. Later on the program, Czeslaw Milosz will read from his latest collection of poems. Linda Gregerson's recent work includes a poem entitled Safe, which appeared first in The Atlantic and subsequently in The Best American Poetry 1991, a collection published by Scribner's. Linda Gregerson also won the 1991 Levinson Prize, awarded by Poetry Magazine. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she's working on a study of the 16th and 17th century English poets Edmund Spenser and John Milton. According to Linda Gregerson, her poem, Safe, is an elegy, a failed rescue attempt, whose larger argument is with loss. She notes that grief in verse has a thousand ways of turning exploitative, especially when death has been accompanied by violence. Linda Gregerson composed her poem, Safe, in memory of a friend who was killed just before Christmas 1986. Linda Gregerson.
The tendons sewn together and the small bones healed, that your hand might close on a pencil again or hold a cup. The delicate muscles made whole again to lift your eyelid and govern your smile, and the nerves new laid in their tracks. The broken point of the kitchen knife, and here let the surgeon be gentle, removed, and the skull knit closed, and the blood lifted out of the carpet and washed from the stairs. And the 19-year-old burglar returned to the cradle or his mother's arms. He must have been harmless once, even he, who is not sorry, had nothing to lose, and will never be harmless again.
Linda, the popular notion is that poets live in a world of ivory towers. They are detached from real life. Here you are writing about something which is very personal, very immediate. Crime in our streets and a great personal loss. How does a poet deal with something like grief?
Well, I think very nervously. The poem is hard to read because there are a thousand ways of doing this wrong. And I suppose there's a way in which this poem actually constructs its own version of an ivory tower. I've noticed recently that this first section, in fact, is written entirely in the subjunctive, which is its frontal confession that it's wishfulness contrary to fact.
You are creating a distance between you and the subject. How did you arrive at the sort of guiding metaphors that you use here?
I actually don't remember directly how I came to individual images for the most part. The poem is written in three sections. I wrote it sequentially. In a way, they follow upon one another, but they're also, frankly, three separate and new efforts to do something impossible, which is to bring back someone who's been lost.
All right. Now, you write about your friend who has been murdered, attacked in her home, in her apartment.
Right.
Then, by counterpoint, in the second section here, which I'd like you to read to me, you talk about your daughter.
Yeah.
Read this section for me and then tell me what you're up to.
Sure. Emma is learning to wield her own spoon, silver for abundance, though it seldom finds her mouth as yet. She hates to be fed, would rather starve, but loves to steer the precarious course herself. Silver for pride, then, or luck of the sort some children are born with, omitting the manifold slippage that separates privilege and weal. Luck in this popular figure is three parts silver anyway, that the child not succumb to crack in the schoolyard, rats in the hall, the clever fence with a shopping list, bad plumbing, bad food, and hatred on a staircase with a knife in hand and dim designs on jewelry or a VCR. The spoon was superfluity. the best part of your paycheck for a child you haven't lived to see. Friend, her cheek is fresh as hope of paradise, and every passing minute in the hours of light, in the hours of darkness, in the fever of pneumonia or the ignorant sweet wash of health, the miraculous breath moves into her lungs, and stitch by mortal stitch moves out. The popular figure referred to is the one about children being born with silver spoons in their mouth, and I frankly was talking about money at some level, which is one of the ways we try to keep ourselves safe and fail. And this poem, it's not to say that the poem is about the rich versus the poor by any means, but it's about the struggling versus the struggling, I think.
Would you say that the poem is about crime in the streets? Is it about
No.
your friend? How do you figure out the interplay between the very public and the very personal?
That's a great question. And I don't know that I have any general answers. I think it's a very brazen and in some ways always morally questionable thing to do, to write an elegy, because one is because of the ways an elegy is self-regarding. And by going to my daughter in this section of the poem, I think I was trying to get very straight with what my stakes are in loss.
Read to me, Linda Gregerson, the third section of your poem, Safe, and here we come, as it were, to the punchline. We've been developing, we've been moving toward the meaning of all of these images. Would you read that for me?
Yeah. When the paramedics came at last, my friend apologized. She must have hit her head, she thought. She'd just take a minute to mop up the mess by the phone. Her broken hands, for which the flaw in memory had provided no such alibi, her broken hands had kept him two or three times from her face. And later, when the anesthesiologist had launched her on his good green gas, and launched her, as they do sometimes, a shade too fast, she slipped the bonds of recall altogether. Safe as houses. You know what a house is for the likes of us. Down payment on the nursing home, our four-square pledge to be debtors of conscience, if debtors in conscience may not look too closely where credit's refused. Our piece of the here for hereafter, which shows us diminished regard and just such a face as fear has made. One night a woman came home to her house and locked its useless locks, and buttoned her nightdress, and read for a while, and slept till she was wakened.
Is the poem about your anger at this hapless and, I take it, hopeless young person who got involved in these awful circumstances and ended up murdering your friend Karen?
I actually don't think the poem is a lot about anger. I think the poem is, because the villains are sort of not the ones who are in here. I mean, the villains are probably the people who leave the struggling to take it out on the struggling. But the last section of this poem, the sort of telling the story as though it were some ghastly inverted fairy tale, one that a woman came home to her house, is also a way of trying to tap into the most traditional gesture of consolation. A lot of the elegies I know from the 16th and 17th century, where the hope for an afterlife, for awakening that's into the arms of God, is the counterpoint to human loss and the corrective, as it were, to human loss. That's not a kind of faith that comes very directly to most of us right now.
There's a lot of literary history at work in this poem,
I take it. That's another way of trying to recoup from loss, right? We've had other people have dealt with this for a long time. It's not the first.
All right, now, apropos of the 16th and 17th century, Linda Gregerson, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. You're writing a book here at the Humanities Center about all sorts of wonderful themes, sex and death and life and
all
Spencer and Milton. What are you doing? As I understand it, I want you to give me a paraphrase here. Are you a sort of a canon buster? Are you coming along and rearranging our inherited notions of these biggies back on the horizon? What's going on?
Well, it's hard to be a canon buster when you're talking about two such canons canonical poets, the white male, you know, literary elite of Edmund Spenser and John Milton. I am, and I'm also writing about the canonized poetic form. I'm writing about epic. I'm writing about the Faerie Queene and Paradise Lost.
Just parenthetically, is the epic dead in the 20th century?
Gee, you know,
does anybody write this stuff anymore?
Well, I have heard of a poet who has written, who set out deliberately to write a poem longer than the Faerie Queene, which and apparently did that. It's not actually. I don't know his name and have not read this thing, and I sort of shudder to think about it. But epic is not something we do very much right now, because frankly, in this country, we're very uncomfortable about the relationship of poetry to public life, mm-hmm. and especially public power.
Well, we've translated it to other media. I mean, we've got sure. movies that
we
call
filmic,
epic, but
right.
I take it
right.
that you see that as a trivialization
no,
of
no,
the word?
No, 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 not at all, actually. I don't happen to be writing about film right now, but I don't see that as a trivialization at all.
Well, back to what you're doing
right.
with Spenser and Milton.
I mean, I, a lot of what draws me to the epic in the 16th and 17th century is precisely the kind of allergy we have for that conjunction right now right. between the poetic project and public life. And you see, in my period, to deal with, because the epic is the poem in which poets have been called upon to try and think on a national scale, to try and think about corporate life among human beings. And in my period, that is the 16th, 17th century, another great embarrassment, of course, for us, and an enormous difficulty for modern readers, is that part of public life was an absolute frontal position toward imperialism. I mean, this is the great period of conquest and expansionism, and one of the poets I'm working on, Edmund Spenser, was an unabashed polemicist on behalf of imperialism.
Are you going to bash him? Are you going to make a judgment about him for this this imperialism? Is that fair to him?
Well,
looking back from our circumstances to his.
The more pertinent question is it of any interest to simply bash from the sort of moral superiority of our current and frankly, you know, we're living in the middle of the violent aftermath of his imperial project. So we have reason to bash, but that's a pretty static position, frankly. And I think it more behooves me certainly, to ask real questions, like how, for instance, an exquisite moral project of the sort that the Faerie Queene is could coexist, could in fact be centrally committed to something in public life that we now regard with moral abhorrence.
Well, what you're doing is mixing and matching the aesthetic and the political dimensions here. Aren't they inseparable?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's exactly the point. And I think why the reason I'm curious is that the particular intersections in Spenser, for instance, fly in the face of all our sort of hegemonic assumptions right now about the way in which public and private ethic works. And so I think it's actually a rather serious challenge. I'm not, I should say, I am not a champion of Edmund Spenser's positions, nor am I interested in the least in becoming an apologist for his set, for instance, for his position toward Ireland, you know, or toward the New World, or toward the poor. But I do take him seriously. I don't think it's my business to condescend simply to Edmund Spenser either.
Well, Linda, I will give you very high marks for what you do with the intersection between the public and the private. Your poems, again, here immediately we've been talking about your project at the Humanities Center, but I want to mention your poems again. Good News won the Levinson Prize from Poetry Magazine, and Safe appeared in The Best American Poetry, 1991. That's published by Collier Books, Macmillan. Linda Gregerson, thanks for your contribution to Soundings. It's a pleasure to have you at the Humanities Center.
Thanks, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Prize-winning poets this week on Soundings. Join me now for Reading and Conversation featuring Czesław Miłosz, the 1980 winner of the Nobel Prize for Poetry. Czesław Miłosz is a native of Lithuania, Since 1960, he's been a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Milos sees poetry as the consciousness of an epic that ideally attains, in his words, the calligraphic quality of an ideogram. He participated on Soundings during a recent visit to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Czeslaw Milos reading from his latest collection of poems, a volume entitled Provinces, published by the Echo Press. The name of the poem is Meaning.
When I die, I will see the lining of the world, the other side, beyond bird, mountain, sunset, the true meaning ready to be decoded. What never added up will add up. What was incomprehensible will be comprehended. And if there is no lining to the world, if a thrush on a branch is not a sign, but just a thrush on the branch, if night and day make no sense following each other, and on this earth there is nothing except the earth, even if that is so, there will remain a word wakened by lips that perish, a tireless messenger who runs and runs through interstellar fields, through the revolving galaxies, and calls out, protests, screams.
Professor Milos, before we talk about your poetry, would you give me a sample of one or two of those lines in the original language, in the Polish, that you used to compose this poetry?
Yes, the beginning of this poem runs in the original, Kiedy umrę, zobaczę podszewkę świata, drugą stronę, za ptakiem, górą, zachodem słońca. Yeah, usually I divide poetry into untranslatable, translatable to some extent, and very well translatable. I would place my poetry in the middle.
Well, that's a good place for a poet to be.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the themes that pervade your poetry. Mystery, myth, recollections of your native land. Is it a world that we have lost?
Well, I guess we lost it because that's a very beautiful valley where I was born, in Lithuania, the center of Lithuania. Well, a valley full of ghosts and devils, very interesting devils.
Are you?
But it's all over.
Are you a believer, literally, in the world of demons and spirits? This is what one of your critics has written, that, and this is what makes you difficult as a modern poet for the modern mind.
Well, I wouldn't say that it should be taken
that literally.
That literally. But I return to my valley. It's polluted now. I do not expect to see unpolluted nature anymore when I go back now.
One of the themes that you pursue in your poetry, Czeslaw Milos, is the notion of the poet as a witness of his or her time. What kind of witness does your poetry provide for the 20th century?
A reluctant witness.
What precisely motivates you to say that?
Well, I am not a great admirer of the so-called commitment in literature. I consider that if one is cornered, one takes upon oneself a commitment, but otherwise it should avoid that.
Help me to understand this, Czeslaw Milos. I understand, for example, that you are not a proponent of poetics and the theories of literature and culture so much as you are a proponent of the weight of history, the meaning of events in poetry and aesthetics. Is this correct?
Yeah, there is a sort of basic reluctance against many literary theories and aesthetic theories of the 20th century.
You said, for example, that to the degree that literature becomes theoretical, feeds upon itself, it leads to the opportunity for the totalitarian state. Tell me what you mean there.
Not quite. I believe that so-called l'écriture and literature feeding upon itself is a result of the loss of faith in truth, it goes back to Nietzsche, of course, is undermining the notion of truth. And the loss of the meaning of the meaning.
When we talk of truth and we say that truth has a capital T, I take it that you are speaking in some fashion here of the religious imagination. Tell me about that.
My permanent problem and very important for me is the erosion of the religious imagination in the 20th century.
Are you a believer, for example, Czesław Miłosz?
Well, I believe that's a very private question, but I would say yes. However, I have been always attracted by various heresies, so you can consider me not necessarily very orthodox.
You put part of the burden at the doorstep of science, do you not?
To some extent, yes. I am a great admirer of science and of undeniable progress in science, but undoubtedly, what we gain, we lose also. There is a pollution of the mind by science. And that erosion of religious imagination is due to that.
How do you talk to yourself about your responsibility as a poet?
Well, I do not talk about my responsibility, but about my likes and dislikes.
That's fair.
Yeah.
What are some of them?
Some of them are very obscure poetry, which feeds, as you said, on words and lacks clarity. It doesn't mean that I believe that all my poems are perfectly clear, uh-huh. But in any case, I try to be clear.
Do you write to satisfy and please yourself or an audience that you imagine in your mind?
No, I have always tried to satisfy an ideal reader or listener, mm-hmm. which exists, who exists or not, but...
How do you want to be remembered as a poet, Czesław Miłosz?
I would like to be remembered as a poet who was aware of what was at stake, namely a big crisis of religion, of Christianity in a post-Nietzschean era.
Do you think that the poet can do anything in our modern world of politics and technology? Is the poet an observer? Is he an actor? Does he bring ideas and people together? How do you think of yourself?
Yes, but I have been in many moments of my life an engaged poet, but I don't like that, in the sense that moral commitment is always in quarrel with artistic achievement.
Czesław Miłosz, what has living in America done to you as a poet? Has it been a happy experience? I mean, what does the poet go through as an expatriate? What does it do to your memory of your homeland, and how does it affect your poetry?
Yeah, I went through very hard periods of isolation, but I'm very happy that I have been living in America.
Do you believe that America provides a model for what, the 21st century? Are we triumphalist in a word? What do we have to learn from other cultures? We've been the teachers for a while. How about the other way around?
I don't know. I have witnessed great changes, you know. In the beginning of the century, America was separated by oceans from the rest of the world. Going to America at that time was to never to return. Mm-hmm. But today, you know, today living in California or living in Warsaw or in Lithuania, it makes no really difference. And I witnessed that shrinking of our planet. So many problems which were big problems in the beginning of this century ceased to be big problems. And that's in everything, in philosophy, in history, everything, it happens in that way, that certain problems which are big at a given moment dissolve, disappear by themselves.
You make me think of the metaphor that runs through your Nobel speech when you talk about the poet experiencing life from a great distance and from the immediate and the concrete, having this sort of double view of one's life and one's culture.
Yes. Well, for me, the detail is very important. And I guess that the best among things I have written stem from observation of the detail.
Czeslaw Milosz, your books include The Captive Mind, The Witness of Poetry, Unattainable Earth, Provinces, your latest collection. You are the Nobel laureate in poetry. Thank you for your contribution to Soundings.
I thank you. It was very fine. Thank you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to Readings and Conversation featuring two prize-winning poets, Linda Gregerson of the University of Michigan and Czeslaw Milosz of the University of California, Berkeley. Linda Gregerson is the recipient of the Levinson Prize, awarded by Poetry Magazine. Czeslaw Milosz was awarded the Nobel Prize for Poetry in 1980. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 609. That's program number 609, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Chinese literature from antiquity into the modern world. My guests will be Zhu Hong of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and Victor Mayer of the University of Pennsylvania. Zhu Hong will talk about images of women in contemporary Chinese literature. Victor Mayer will discuss his translation of the Tao Te Ching, the classic book of Chinese religion and philosophy. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Prize-winning poets, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Readings and Conversation featuring the winners of the Nobel and Levinson Prizes for Poetry. Linda Gregerson and Czeslaw Milosz read and discuss selections from their award-winning poems. Prize-winning poets, some readings, answers, and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.